Okay, so welcome everybody to that's class number three in our series on En Muqaddam U Mu'akhar, in chronological integrity. But because this week it's already Rosh Chodesh Adar, we have two classes before Purim. Rabbi Jay asked me to dedicate two classes to Purim. And since everything is before and after, so my title is, when did the story of Purim happen before or after the temple was, the second temple was rebuilt? And let me give a little introduction. I'll share my source sheet on the, I'll share it once again on the chat. And now it'll be on the website. And now we're going to put it on my screen and we can get to work. Okay, we're up to 70. That's good. Share screen. And here we are. Okay, so when did the story of Purim take place? Now, everyone knows the story of Megillat Esther. It's probably the most well-known. But there's a big argument about when it took place. Now, everyone knows it's sometime or in the early Second Temple period. Whether it's before the temple was destroyed or not, that's the big question. So everyone agrees it's during the Persian time period because Ahasuerus is a king of Paras and Madai. He's a Persian king. And the first Persian king, according to everyone, is Cyrus the Great or Koresh. And he's the one who conquered Babylonia. So it has to be after Cyrus and hence after the famous Cyrus decree, allowing the Jews to return. I'm not going to do the whole series. We did like a 10-part series on Koresh and the Balfour Declaration and all the Zionist stuff in the missing years. That's too complicated. We're going to focus only on the Megillah. However, the question, when the story of Megillah took place, will have an effect on what the message is going to be. So in rabbinic literature, based on Seder Olam, which we'll dedicate a little time to in next week's share, Ahasuerus is identified as the king right after Cyrus, right after Koresh, but before Darius, and hence before the temple was rebuilt. It was after the return to Zion, but during the 18 years between the return and actually constructing the second temple. But when you consider outside history and secular sources and Tanakh itself, it's more likely that the story of Purim happened that Ahasuerus would be Xerxes, and he's the Persian king who reigned right after Darius. And hence, like 20, 30 years after the second temple was built. So I have a little table here just to review without getting to any of the details in the years, just real simple. If I follow Seder Olam, which is rabbinic chronology, and it's list of Persian kings, there's three Persian kings in their chronology who reigned for a total of 40 years in total, or 52 actually altogether by mistake. It's 52 years altogether. I meant 52. Sorry about that. 34, 40. Yeah, 52 years. 40 years from the time of the temple. It's 40 years of, we'll get to the 40 years in a minute. But it's, just erase that 40 years. That's a mistake. Okay, I'll erase that. Never mind. But basically, there's Koresh, who reigned for 3 years, Ahasuerus for 14 years, and Dariavish for 34 years. And Dariavish is our Takshasta. I want next week we'll talk about that a little bit. But the main thing is, if you remember, there's 18 years between the first year of Koresh and the second year of Dariavish. And 14 of those years, according to Seder Olam, is the story of Megillat Esther and Ahasuerus' rule, because Ahasuerus is king for 14 years in Megillat Esther minimum. Now, that's the classic rabbinic interpretation. But the reason for that has nothing to do with the story of Purim, has everything to do with Seder Olam and the rabbinic midrash, turning the Greek year into a Jewish year and dating to the Exodus, and we dedicated a whole series on that a year ago or so. Next week, I might, if we have time, we'll relate to it, but I don't want to get tied down to that. I'm going to follow in today's share, shot in the books of Ezra, the works of the Nevuot of Haggai and Zechariah, and the outside history, which matches Tanakh perfectly. And if I take the famous list of Persian kings, it's very easy to identify who Ahasuerus is, because Koresh is the first Persian king who captured Babylonia. That's in 538 in all the books. There's another king afterwards for several years named Cambyses, short reign, who's not mentioned in Tanakh by that name. Then there's Dariavish, who clearly is Darius, or Darius the Great, who reigned in 522 BC. That's when the temple is destruction finally begins. It begins in year two and finishes in year six, as we'll see today. Those sources are all in the book of Ezra and Haggai and Zechariah. After Darius, before Artaxerxes, before Artaxasta, is the reign of Ahasuerus or Xerxes. And the name, if I dump the Aleph, Shashrash, Xaxras, Xerxes, fits Ahasuerus perfectly because you always add an Aleph to take a Persian name to make it Jewish. We'll talk about name changing later on. But that would put our story, when did the story of Megiddo happen? That would put it between Darius and Artaxasta, and hence after the temple was built, but before Ezra the person comes back and fixes things up in Jerusalem, and before Nehemiah comes. Now, today's shir is going to be based, it's not going to prove this, it's going to assume this. Today's shir is going to assume that Daryavesh reigned before Ahasuerus, and Daryavesh, under Daryavesh's rule, the Jews were allowed to rebuild the temple. They began construction in year two. That's explicit in Haggai. They finished in year six in the book of Ezra, we'll see. And hence the story of Megillat Esther happens some 20, 30 years after the temple is rebuilt. And the question is going to be, does the story of Megillat Esther relate to that historical event or that reality? Now, a little bit of introduction. Okay. This will be an introduction, and then we'll get to work. Actually, I'm going to stop here for a minute. I'm going to ask you a different question. We'll get to Asher's question at the end. I don't want to deal with the history. I'll deal with history later on with Cambyses, et cetera. Now, chat number three. Okay, I'll get to the chat later on, unless it's something, Rabbi G, if there's something critical in the chat, let me know. Otherwise, I'll save it for later. Point. I want to start somewhere totally different, but just to get my point across. I'm sure all of you have learned the book of Judges, right? Sefer Shoftim. Agreed? Now, in the story of Pelegish Begiva, which we're all familiar with, someone tell me what imagery does the book of Shoftim use in the story of Pelegish Begiva that relates to a famous story in Chumash? Just want to make sure you're all aware of what I'm talking about. You all know the story of Pelegish Begiva? Now, what imagery?
Lot and his two daughters.
Yeah, you can't miss that, right? Unless you're blind. The author of Sefer Shoftim, the prophet Shmuel, is clearly, I don't want to say the word plagiarizing, but clearly using words, keywords, from the story of Lot and his daughters, Lot and Stone, to describe what's happening in Giva. Now, I don't think it's just by chance that in that story, using the exact same words. Said Shmuel the Navi is purposely using the same phrases that we find in the story of Stone and Lot, he's purposely using it in the story of Pelegish Begiva, because his prophetic point in the book is he wants the reader to connect what's happening in Israel, how bad things are in Israel's society, and hence we need a king, or we need some reform, some governmental reform, without getting into modern day Israeli politics. But my point is, the prophetic author, Shmuel Navi, is purposely using imagery from Chumash in order to make its prophetic point. And I want to say that becomes a minhag all through Tanakh, meaning a later Navi is going to assume that his audience is aware of earlier books of prophecy. You can't miss it when you see Navim later on. And when we find a later Navi using imagery from Chumash or from an earlier Navi, he wants his audience, his readership, to connect that story thematically to what he's alluding to. Sometimes he'll say it explicitly, sometimes it'll be implicit. And therefore, the question is going to come up when I'm reading the book of Esther and I find allusions to earlier books of Tanakh, can I assume that that's intentional? And the question is, what's the message going to be? Now, I'm going to share my screen again, and I want to make a couple allusions. I want to make a couple assumptions, okay? The first thing I want to do is I want to consider what I call author's intent or prophetic intent when you study the books of the Bible. I'll give you a real quick example. When I'm studying Sefer Bereshit, I have to ask myself, why did God give me the book of Sefer Bereshit? Why did God give Am Yisrael the book of Sefer Bereshit? Do we need to know how God created? But then I have big questions with when I study science. Do I need to know that God created? That could be the purpose of the book. Do I need to know why God chose the Jewish nation? Do I need to know that we're chosen? I'm not giving the answer to those questions, But that's something the reader has to consider when I'm reading the book of Sefer Bereshit. What was the reason why God gave Am Yisrael the book? Was it to give you history, to tell you what happened, or to understand why we're chosen? Of course, I'm going to go in the direction of when we study Sefer Bereshit, or when I teach Sefer Bereshit, I'm assuming God gave Am Yisrael the book to understand why we're chosen. And to understand why we're chosen, he has to explain to us the story of creation. I'll just give you an example from this week's Parsha. If when Sefer Bereshit tells the story of Gan Eden, and God puts Kruvim to guard the path to return to Derech Etz Chaim, to the Tree of Life, and the only other time I find Kruvim in Chumash is in the Mishkan, when the Kruvim are guarding, and the Kruvim are just guarding, they're on the Parochet, they're on the Kaporet, they're on the Uriot of the Mishkan. The Mishkan's imagery is screaming Kruvim, and it's all leading up to the Aron, the Luchot HaBrit, then that might be alluding to the fact that what's replacing Gan Eden or the Eitz HaChaim is going to be the Torah. It could be, and you know, Mishle says it pretty much explicitly, of Eitz HaChaim l'machazikim ba. But again, that's just an example. When I read Sefer Bereshit, is the story of creation there to tell me what happened or to help me understand later what's the meaning of our sin and what's the meaning of the Torah and what's the meaning of God choosing us? So I'm going to follow the latter when we ever study Sefer Bereshit. But that's just an example of how you have to take that into consideration. The same thing as a flood story to tell you what happened or to set you up to appreciate what's happening in Har Sinai with 40 days and 40 nights and finding favor in God's eyes and a Teva and all the famous parallels between Noach and Moshe Rabbeinu in the story of the flood and later Noach and Avram Avinu. But that's the question. When I read a book of prophecy, when I find parallels, textual parallels, is that intentional? And how I have to pay attention to that to understand the message of the book. Now, I want to take something from Ktuvim. Now, I brought example from Bereshit and from Nevi'im, from Sefer Shoftim. I want to bring something from Ktuvim, which we're all familiar with. The book of Shir HaShirim. If you're allowed to read, I guess you're allowed to read it. Sometimes it's difficult to teach the high school kids, even though they'll enjoy it. There's no doubt it's a love story. According to Chazal, that book was written for what purpose? Help us understand the complexity of the relationship between God and his people. In fact, if you follow all the classic Parshanim, especially the Kuzari, he's saying one of the key illusions is how do you read the hand of God in history? Now, in that love affair, and how do you say, does God want me back? No, is God angry with us and it's not time for a relationship? Or is God sort of winking, it's time to come back? So in a love relationship, it's difficult to understand what messages are being transmitted. And is Shir HaShirim written is that a love story whose entire purpose of its composition is for the audience to understand the complexity and the depth of the relationship between God and his people. And if that's the author's intent, I have to read the love story with that in mind to interpret the message. Or was it written as a love story and the rabbi sort of hijacked the book? That's what they tell you in academia. But if I follow Chazal, the book was written on purpose to help explain the complexity of that relationship between God and his people. And if that's true, that sort of allows us to say the book the way Chazal do. Now, that's why Ibn Ezra has a double pirush. First is what's the simple pshat of the story? And in light of that, what's the deeper meaning of the story? I'll give you one bad example, not from Tanakh. George Orwell's book, Animal Farm, which I'm sure you all read. Animal Farm was written with the assumption that the audience knows the story of the Russian Revolution, if I'm not mistaken, correct? Now, I can read the book and understand the book totally without knowing the word about the Russian Revolution, as I did in high school. I remember we had a class to do that. I had no idea what the Russian Revolution was. I thought it was just a great book. Only later I realized that it's about the Russian Revolution, which made it even more meaningful. But I can write a book, but there's no doubt that George Orwell wrote the book whose intended audience were people who knew the Russian Revolution, but never spills the beans. Now, so with that in mind, I want to get to work on Megillat Esther. Let me go back to my source sheet and bring one more example. What was my last example? Was from Divrei Yamim, which we have to relate to later on. When I'm reading Divrei Yamim, was that book written to teach you history? Or is it a very specific history, a very spun history for a prophetic point? That's when we study Divrei Yamim, we'll see that that book was written to discuss the history of all the efforts that Am Yisrael made to build the Beit HaMikdash, the first temple, and it's the history of the first temple period, and all the efforts done to build up Yerushalayim in the temple. Written in the second temple period is a book of inspiration in the second temple period time, based on stories from the first temple period. When I understand that, that explains what's in Divrei HaYamim and what's not in Divrei HaYamim, and why there are contradictions, what's left in, what's left out. And once you understand that, it explains a lot of discrepancies between Divrei HaYamim and Malachim, especially explains what's in the book, what's not in the book, and what I learned from the book. Okay. So when we apply that to Megillat Esther, now, when I'm reading Megillat Esther, I have to entertain the question, why did, according to Chazal, the book was written by Anshei Knesset HaGdolah, the members of the Great Assembly. Was it written by Mordechai and Esther? Unclear. Chazal says it's written, attributed to Anshei Knesset HaGdolah, which is probably the time of Ezra. Again, who originally wrote it, who redacted it, who put it in its final form, you can argue, but it's definitely Second Temple literature, but wasn't written just to tell you what happened. It's written to explain the customs of Purim and telling you that everyone's keeping Purim and how we have to keep Purim. Now, in this story, it's a story, it's written for surely like a fairy tale. That, I'm not, again, I'm not doubting its historicity. It's a story that happened, but the way the story is told in the fairy tale style with everything, you know, working perfectly, like it's like written, it's simply a masterpiece in composition. And what was the reason for its composition? And what's the book alluding to? And does it have a message, even though God's name is not mentioned, does it have a message for the Jewish people, for that generation, for future generations? And therefore, is it just information? Is it halachic to know how to celebrate Purim? Is it philosophical? They're telling us how to, or theological, to see the hand of God in history? And again, who's the intended audience? And when I write the book, does the author of Megillat Esther assume that its readers knows Chumash? Does it know Shirat Hazino? Does it know the Vot of Zechariah? Does it know Yirmiyahu, Yechezkel, etc.? That's the big question. So we're going to make the following assumptions. That the author of Megillat Esther is assuming that his audience is aware of the history of that time period, which we can learn from the book of Ezra and Nehemiah. He's also familiar with key themes of Chumash, like God wants a people, and God gave us the land of Israel, and he wants us to be a nation, to be like other nations, etc. He's aware of the later prophets as well, like Yirmiyahu, we'll see. And he understands, there's no doubt he's aware of Yirmiyahu, and knows about the idea of exile and redemption. Okay. I'm assuming the reader is aware of Persian history, and what's the proof of that is the first line. And which Achashverosh, the Persian king who's reigned from Hodu Ad Kush, from India to Ethiopia. Okay. And it's a king that everyone's aware of, but actually relate to that time period. And also the question is, where are the Jewish people supposed to be at that time? And therefore, do we expect them to know what's happening in the book of Haggai and Zechariah, who are the most recent prophets of that time period? Now, one last principle we'll discuss, which we've talked about many times, I just want to review it. We call this objective analysis, objective interpretation, meaning what? I can analyze a book, and I can prove that there's a parallel between, for example, the book of Shoftim and the story of stone. Whereas I can objectively prove that there are words in the story of Pilegish Begiva that match the story of stone. That's objective. What's the meaning of that parallel? That's subjective. So then there's objective analysis, finding parallels. And then the question is, what's the meaning of those parallels? That's subjective interpretation. The first thing I want to do today is simply do what's called objective analysis. I want to show you that there are certain phrases and certain things happening in Megillat Esther that seem to be relating to bigger things from Chumash and in earlier Nevi'im and certain words and phrases. Then the question is going to be, why is the author doing that? And is there a message behind it? Okay, that was point number one. And now we're going to get to work and get started. Okay. Now, the historical background. Just a quick review again. If you were in my course over a year ago about from Cyrus to Balfour, whatever it was called. Just the key points we're aware of. I want to review them briefly but highlight points that relate to Megillat Esther. Let me just stop to share for a second and a couple questions to make sure people are alive. Tell me what they taught you about why were the Jewish people almost punished in the time of Achashverosh, according to Chazal. Right? What was their terrible sin that the rabbis pick up on? What were they doing wrong in exile? Just give me some famous... Okay. Number one, they all know we were enjoying a good meal. Now, how long was that party for? I forget how long. The party, I think it was 180 days.
180 days.
That's a serious party, isn't it? In the third year of his reign, 180 party. And when the party is over, there's a 7-day party, right? And a super duper party for the last 7 days. Imagine a 7-day inaugural, a 7-day party after. I think we're reading about the Mishkan just for the fun of it. The commandment to build the Mishkan we received on, I think, right after Yom Kippur, right? And we put it together, Rosh Chodesh Nisan. It's about a half a year, close to 180 days. But the last 7 days, right? When we put it together, there's a 7-day inaugural ceremony after the 180 days of construction. Right? It could be just coincidental. But a 7-day party at the end of a long. Now, if you know your outside history, if you read Herodotus, it's amazing, because in the third year of his reign, Herodotus, who doesn't know Megillat Esther, but knows Persian history, he's a Greek historian who knows Persian history, because the Greeks and the Persians were fighting each other for hundreds of years. They were each other's throats. The famous Battle of Marathon, the Battle of Salamis, there's all these famous, right? They were fighting over who's going to run the globe, basically, during that, and who's going to be king of kings. And when Darius wants to make himself, when Xerxes, the successor of Darius, wants to be greater than Darius. Darius lost the Battle of Marathon. But Xerxes wants to reconquer and get Greece back. There was a stalemate between them. Greece didn't take over Persia, and Persia didn't take over Greece. They're both big powers. Persia, Xerxes, wants to take over Greece. He puts the biggest army ever together, crosses the Bosphorus. You can read about it in Xerxes. In the third year of his reign is when he masses his army in Shushan, right, to plan the battle. And for about a half a year, all the soldiers, the whole giant Persian army, is massed together in Shushan. And from there, they begin their march to the Bosphorus and which ends with the famous Battle of Salamis in the 7th year of his reign, when he loses terribly, and of course he has to find a scapegoat. But that might just be coincidental that it matches all these events in Megillat Esther, or it could be just by chance again. I mean, it could be by chance, or it could be the reader might know that. Okay, it's called the Million Man March of Xerxes. Very good. So I didn't make it up. It's a famous story. And before, when they gather in Shushan, he makes a big speech that I'm going to become king of all kings. Now, back to the Megillah. So the Megillah begins again in year 3 of Achashverosh, and he makes a big mishteh for his things. Now, give me another reason they tell you. Oh, so the Jews enjoy the party. Now, but not just they enjoy the party. It's really hard to find. If the Jews are found, if it's not good to enjoy a good meal, we're in big trouble. That's half of being Jewish is enjoying good meals. Okay. We're talking about four names in a minute. We'll get to that in a minute. Amalia's comment. Now back to, give me other reasons. What specifically did they do with the meal wrong?
They used the kelim from the base of Mikdash.
Gosh, and we make a big deal about that when we read kelim shonim with the nigud avecha. Just time for one joke, Rabbi Jay, okay?
It's a very bad joke.
Maybe you've heard it before. But the question is, why do we use the
Nigun of Echa? You don't have to do it. You don't have to fall asleep.
Wait a second. Let me. You got it, Rabbi? I got it. You know, okay. There we go. Start back again. There's a custom of several, like three or four different psukim in Megillah that we read like Echa. Remember? Which means our custom is to remember the destruction of the temple. There's no doubt. Now, so the question is that why are we bringing such sad, you know, memories when we read the Megillah? So the joke is that, you know what Misnagdim are? Misnagdim, their favorite holiday is Tisha B'Av. Yeah, they enjoy fasting, you know, suffering, etc. like that. So they say, so if it's not being Shev, a little simcha in Purim, we read a couple of psukim like Eicha. So then they ask, so if that's the case, read the whole thing like Eicha. Says that would be too much. That's over, that's Hisalolus already. That's already too much. That's the famous Yeshivas joke about the custom. If you're a Chassid, you'll like that. If you're a Misnagid, you'll be angry with me. I'm just quoting a famous joke. Now, back to our topic. I'm sorry about that, but I had to share the joke. Now, back to our topic. What's our topic? Our topic is Mikiyat Hester. The rabbis say, Mikilim Shodim, were the vessels of the Beit HaMikdash that were still, that Nebuchadnezzar took, that Koresh, when he defeated the Babylonians, took them from Nebuchadnezzar, and they're using it because I guess they need Pesach, whatever. They didn't have enough dishes, so they're using the dishes of the Beit HaMikdash for the party. Now, so that's sort of like called misdemeanor. No, that's called Mila. You shouldn't do it. But for some reason, the rabbis are assuming that when the Megillah writes Mikilim Shonim, it's written so that the reader remembers something about the Beit HaMikdash. Now, was that a technicality that I did a little of era, or is it relating to something bigger? And the rabbis go farther, and they suggest a different reason for Achashverosh's party. What's he celebrating in the 30th year of his reign? We'll talk about this next week. What happened in the 30th year of his reign, according to the rabbinical tradition? Who's making a party because Jeremiah's 70 years were over, and the Jews didn't return. Okay, like the only thing the king Xerxes, Achashverosh, was worried about, this king who's going to take over, defeat Greece, he's so worried about Jeremiah's prophecies that none of the Jews accepted and listened to him. The Jewish people didn't listen to Yirmiyahu. Boy, they didn't listen to him. And all of a sudden, this great king is worried about Yirmiyahu, which is, it can't be pshat. But in Drash, what are they doing? They're connecting the party to Yirmiyahu's prophecies. And we're going to do that in our shir. That's a question. And it was actually, I had a family, like really cute this Shabbat. My 10, 11-year-old granddaughter for Shabbat, and she was reading Parsha. She's reading now. So she was reading Parsha Truma, which she never read before. But in school, they're learning Megillat Esther. And she was reading the first psukim of Parsha Truma. And she says, Sabbat, it sounds just like Megillat Esther. No, but the gold and silver. So that means the author of Megillat Esther intentionally is using imagery from the Mishkan. And Chazal pick up on that, don't they? That's just the beginning of Shanim, Chor, Kapasu, Tchelet, and things like that. And the description of his palace, etc. So that's the question. Is the author of Megillat Esther purposely using imagery from the Mishkan and from the Mikdash to describe Shushan? And what's the message behind it? So again, is that intentional? Or again, is that just by chance? Okay. Joyce is mentioning that the Jews were intermingling with the were socializing with non-Jews. That, put it this way, I'm assuming that happened because that's what happens at a party. That the but that's what happens, which makes sense when I want to relate a text I'm reading publicly to modern day Jewish problems. So we have problems nowadays. If you're living in a community where intermingling with non-Jewish neighbors is dangerous and leads to assimilation, so that would be a good message from Megillat Esther. Was that the reason for the Megillah? That you could argue. But it's definitely a worthy message if you're a shul rabbi dealing with assimilation. Now, as far as King Darius being the son of Esther, that's the Midrashic interpretation we'll get to next week. I'll leave that alone for now. Also, my main point today is that is the author Megillat Esther purposely using temple imagery, right, in order to connect the story of Megillat Esther with the fact that the Jews have not come back to build their temple? And they're, should they be in exile or shouldn't they be in exile? Now remember, according to everybody, it's after the Cyrus Declaration and after there's time to return. If the temple is built or not, that's a different question. But it's definitely according to everybody after there was an opportunity to return to Israel and rebuild the temple. Now we're going to read those verses in a minute. So now with that in mind, let's take a look at our source sheet again. And we're going to read from the book of Ezra. The famous Cyrus Declaration, which were all, I don't want this one. I want my source sheet, not my Tanakh. Stop that share and do this share. Here we go. No, I did it wrong again. Share screen. I need Adobe. Here we go. Okay. So Megillat Esther, the first year of Koresh, remember? Lichlot v'Hashem Yipir Yirmiyahu. Clearly, the first year of Koresh is when Yirmiyahu's 7 years are over, the 7 years of Babylonian rule, and Yirmiyahu relates to them, we'll see very soon. Okay? For political reasons, Cyrus, the king of Persia, allows all the nations to return to the homeland and rebuild their temples, including the Jewish people. And the Navi is putting, or the book of Ezra is putting words of God in Koresh's mouth, basically. He's saying, Koresh is saying, God gave me all the lands, and he commanded me to build a house for God in Jerusalem. Now, if you know the real text, the original text of the Cyrus Declaration, which you can see in the British Museum, Cyrus attributes it to Marduk, the Babylonian king, who's very upset with the Babylonian people, with the Babylonian leadership. And the Babylonian god Marduk is so upset with Babylonian leaders who are mistreating its people, he allows the Persians to take over Babylonia. So Cyrus basically thanks Marduk in the Cyrus Declaration. And here, in the book of Ezra, we're attributing it to, that's not Marduk, and that's not Koresh, that's really God behind the events. In Isaiah chapter 44 and 45, he says that explicitly, that idea that Koresh doesn't realize that he's a puppet in the hand of God. Okay, so he says, anyone in your nation who wants to go to Yerushalayim and build a house for God can go. Famous line. Anyone that says behind should send money. And for, it's important for our story, the Melech Koresh would see it, Chlei Beit Hashem. After he gave them permission to go back and build the temple in Jerusalem, he took out these vessels of the Beit HaMikdash, right, which the Nebuchadnezzar had taken out of Jerusalem and put in his palace, Nebuchadnezzar did. Koresh took those vessels out of Nebuchadnezzar's palace, okay, and gave them to the Jewish people, to Sheshbazzar, their leader, to bring them back to Yerushalayim. Which means in Pshat, this according to everyone is before Megillat Esther, in Pshat, the Kelim of the Beit HaMikdash have returned to Jerusalem. Now, so how could the Chazal say the Kelim Kelim Shem or Kelim Beit HaMikdash? One answer is he didn't send all the Kelim; he only saved maybe only the only some of them, not all of them. But it could be that the reason why the Kelim Kelim Shunim is in Megillat Esther is because of these psukim in the Book of Ezra. That everyone should know that the Kelim of the Beit HaMikdash are back, but the Kelim are back, but the Jews aren't back. They're still in Shushan. Especially if the story is happening after Koresh, which for sure it is. Now, this opening line, it's the first year of Koresh, just as Yirmiyahu had predicted. What was Yirmiyahu's prediction? Yirmiyahu told the people to stay in Babel for the next 70 years until the Babylonians fall. And Yirmiyahu tells the people, after 7 years of Babel are over, I'll remember you. I'll keep my promise to bring you back to this land. But I'm going to give you the opportunity to return. You have to want to return. What do you need to do? You have to call out to me and then come. Pray to me and I'll hear your prayer. If you look for me in exile and want to return, if you really want to return and become the God's people again and keep the Torah properly and build a nation and society representing God properly, then I'll bring you back and allow you to rebuild your temple. If you learn from your, in your rehab, you learn from your mistakes and come back to fix it. Then the Nim Seyte Lechem Nim Hashem, I'll be there for you, God says. V'shapti Shvutchem, I'll bring you back from your exile. I'll gather you from all the nations, okay? And I'll bring you back to the place from which you were exiled. Now, if you remember the beginning of Megillat Esther, remember who's Mordechai Yisrael, Glam Yerushalayim, Megol Asher Glatai, Yechoniah Melech Bavel, Yirmiyahu's prophecy began Yirmiyahu's prophecy is going to be fulfilled in the time of Koresh. That's the opening line of the book of Ezra. And therefore, don't be surprised to find some connection between Mordechai, whose ancestry is going to be related to the exile of Joachim from Yerushalayim in the end of the first temple period, as Yirmiyahu had predicted. Now, even though they come back under Koresh, we know from the book of Ezra, chapter 4, quickly, the local population wasn't happy with the Jews rebuilding the temple. Then Intifada started. The local population was weakening the people of Yehuda and scaring them from building. They got a building freeze. They were able to get lobbyists with the Persian authorities. Koyime Koresh until the time of Daryavesh. There's a building freeze between Koresh and Daryavesh. It's 18 years altogether. And only in the second year of Daryavesh were able to build the temple again, and that's in the book of Haggai. And therefore, in year two of Daryavesh, In the sixth month, Haggai tells the people, God's saying, the people are saying, it's not time to build a house for God. He says, pay attention to your ways, climb up the mountain, start cutting down trees, build a house for God, and God will want it. Basically, Haggai's job, and Haggai's message in year two of Dariavesh, is to get to work on the temple, and things will get better. And then he promises, Gadoyek for Abayit Hazeh, Jerusalem can be great again, better than the first temple, if you take an effort and get to work on the temple and build a good society. That's Haggai, and later followed by Zechariah, without going into all the details. Zechariah, his colleague, also in year two of Dariavesh, says, I'm returning to Yerushalayim, you know, with mercy. Beiti Baneba, my house will be rebuilt there. And that's all the famous Haftarah from Hanukkah. Rani Bisimchi Bat Zion. Zechariah tells people, be happy in year two of Dariavesh, because my Shekhinah is returning. And I'll stop to share for a minute and just go over the key points. Basically, in the second year of Dariavesh, we finally begin construction of the second temple, and it's finished in year six. We see that in the book of Ezra, chapter six. They finished construction in year six. The source that we're going to focus on today is going to be from another prophecy in the book of Zechariah from year four. There's going to be certain themes in year four of Zechariah when the people in Babylonia send a letter to Jerusalem, and they want to know whether we continue fasting on the fast days. In other words, there's a community in exile in Babylonia under Persian rule, questioning, now that the temple is being rebuilt, the news of the temple being rebuilt gets to the exile. And the question is going to be, they've been fasting for the last 70 years on the four fast days. Do they continue fasting on Tisha B'Av now that the temple is being rebuilt? And that's what the topic of Zechariah chapter 7 and 8 is about. We're going to find allusions in that chapter to events of Megillat Esther. Now, a quick question, a little participation for a minute. I'll ask you a real simple question. Okay? What's the logic of our custom of eating matzah to remember Yitzhak Mitzrayim? Just what's the simple logic of it? God commands it, but why is God commanding us to eat matzah on the anniversary of the Exodus?
Because we ate it then.
Because that's how you remember the holiday. For those who are Americans, why do we eat, I'm sorry about this for Canadians, but why do you eat turkey on Thanksgiving? Because
to remember the pilgrims. Yeah.
Okay. Whenever you have a holiday to remember historical events, you do something related to the event. Now, I'll give you an example. Why do we eat Hamutashen on Purim? Because Haman's hat was just like that, wasn't it? Didn't you learn that song growing up? Like Nash Nash Humantash? I'm pretty sure. Some of you remember. If you don't, that's right. But we have a custom of eating Humantasha because Haman's hat was just like that. So that makes sense. But it doesn't say to do that in Megillat Esther. I don't think we have historical sources of Haman's hat being just like that, but that's a modern day medrash. I don't know how, maybe a couple hundred years old. Now, but seriously, usually customs of a holiday relate to the content of the holiday, right? We sit in a sukkah on sukkahs to remember we sat in sukkah in the desert. Basically, whenever you have a ritual on a holiday, the ritual relates to the holiday. Now, according to Megillat Esther, how do we celebrate Purim? Someone remind me. Not according to law nowadays. Nowadays, we read the Megillah, we get drunk, all these different things we do. But according to Megillat Esther, how are we supposed to celebrate Purim? We're going to read the source in a minute. Mishloach manot ish l'reihu, maton dav yonim, and making a mishteh. On the same day that was a day of sorrow, becomes a day of, remember, we're going to take a sad day, turn it into a holiday. And on that day, we're going to have matonot dav yonim, and manot ish l'reihu, and a mishteh, got it? It's very simple. Now, that's nice. A holiday, you have to eat, right? And you should take care of poor people. But what's unique to Purim of that celebration? What is there in those, in that celebration of a holiday?
Well, God's name is not mentioned there. God's name is not mentioned there. And Aster Astir Panai.
Okay, you're bringing up a different question, Ruchama, right? Is that you're bringing up, why isn't God's name mentioned in Megillat Esther? Okay, that's a good question. Now, it could be because God has nothing to do with the story, or it could be what we called last week obfuscation. I think we talked about that, didn't we? Maybe not. Obfuscation is when you hide something because you want someone to find it. If it's a book, if it's canonized and God's name is missing, then the media is the message. Because if God wants us to look for the hand of God behind history, but God's hidden, just like he's hidden in nature. You can't see God. You can perceive God. But at Har Sinai, God was Nikla. You could see him. In the Mishkan, according to the Ramban, he's hidden. But you can perceive God. But in nature, God's behind nature, but he's hiding in nature. With proper education, you can perceive God. The question is, when I look at historical events, can I see the hand in God in historical events? And if so, what's the meaning of those events? How do I interpret the events? Number one, I can thank God for being involved in my history and saving me. Or the question is God sending me a message in that history? If something bad happens to the Jewish people, is God sending us a message he's not happy with our behavior? Again, not on the individual level, but on the national level. If you read Shema every day, you can't miss that point, right? If something disastrous is happening to the Jewish people, if you read Shlomo's prayer in Sefer Melachim when he builds a temple, his key point is that in Jewish history, things can go good or bad for the nation. If things go bad, it's a wake-up call because we're doing something wrong. What we're doing wrong, ask your local prophet or ask your local rabbi and to find out what someone else is doing wrong. But in general, again, on the national level, when something bad happens, it's a wake-up call. So once it could be it's anti-Semitism. That's always an easy excuse. Always blame. It's never our fault. It's always someone else's fault. But Nevi'im usually never go that way. I read in Yeshayahu that God sent Ashur to punish us because of our unjust society. And Yirmiyahu says God sent the Babylonians to punish us because of our unjust society and how we were not sanctifying, our society was desecrating God's name instead of sanctifying it. And we had no right to a temple. That's what the Nevi'im say all the time. And in fact, Nevi'im are screaming, other nations, God uses them to punish us. Now, how do we know what we're doing wrong? That's a difficult question when you don't have the Navi. Yirmiyahu told us what we're doing wrong. Don't listen to him anyhow. But it could be that we have enough Navim, enough historical history of Navim, who tell us what were the main things that makes God angry that we can learn from, that we can apply them to today. But again, that's for your local rabbi to give a Musa Shmuz. I just want to get back to Megillat Esther. And that's the question going to be, what do I take into consideration when I study Megillat Esther of what's happening, what's behind the wording of the Megillah? Now, let's get back to our topic. Why the celebration of Purim to remember God saving us from Haman? Why a party? Okay, Yom Tov's a party. Okay. Mishloach Manot, what's wrong with that? Matot Levyonim, that's part of being Jewish. But there's nothing unique to Purim, to the Purim story, is there? Unless you talk about unity, right? Remember, there's a nation scattered, and all the Jews get together and pray together. It could be. Remember?
But originally, they wanted to make it a Yom Tov.
Who wanted to make it Yom Tov?
In the Megillah.
Oh, in the Megillah. It became a Yom Tov. You mean Yom Tov with Yisro Malacha?
Yes, and then
they
didn't.
Well, it could be. That doesn't say that, but that's one possible interpretation. Are there any other holidays where we give Matanot Levyonim?
Rosh Hashanah.
But there's two things. Manot Ishmael.
Shavuot.
Every holiday, you always have to take care of the poor and the needy, don't you?
The Bikurim was special.
What?
The Bikurim was special.
In fact, I mentioned before that even on Shabbat, there's a mitzvah to feed the poor people on Shabbat. Remember, the first mission in Shabbat, it's teaching you about caring on Shabbat, remember?
But there's everyone a special the first Rosh Shabbat.
The Ani is standing outside and the Baal Bayit is inside. But we're learning the laws of Otzah about moving things from one Rashut, how do you say that? From one domain to another. But it's not by chance that the first Mishnah talks about a poor person standing outside and the Baal Bayit, the owner or the homeowner, giving food to a poor person outside. Remember, you're delivering food to a poor person on Shabbat to make him. So how are you allowed to do it? But it's not by chance that Shabbat is about caring for the less fortunate. It says so in the Ten Commandments, doesn't it? At least in Devarim. Okay? So that But Shabbat is not just remember that God created, to remember, to appreciate why He chose you and how you have to behave. Now back to the Megillah. My question is going to be, these customs of Purim, what's behind them? And we're going to run out of time because I have to finish time for Rav Amnon, so let's get right to work. I want to show you in Zechariah now, in the Navi Zechariah, things that I think can't be by chance. In chapter 7 in Zechariah, it's year 4, means the temple is almost built. It's been under construction for 2 years. It's going to finish in a year and a half's time, in 2 years' time. The people from the exile send a letter and ask the question, do we continue fasting on the fast days? Okay. And God gives the famous answer, I didn't ask you to fast. Don't ask me. The Rabbanans ask me diaraitot, basically. God's saying, don't ask me about rabbinical customs of fasting to remember the temple being destroyed. You decided to fast. You decide to eat. Okay? But if you wonder what God wants you to do, don't remember what happened. Remember why it happened. So he says, all the things that the earlier Nevi'im, what we call Nevi'im Achronim, he calls Nevi'im Rishonim, what the earlier prophets told you when your shrine was sitting pretty and everything was fine, you can read these later on your own. Okay? And in case you forgot why God destroyed the first temple, here it is. Okay? God said, Mishpatim et Shvotim, make sure your society is full of justice. But in Dishan Chesed Brachim Asu Ishatachiv, have kindness and mercy to one another. Okay? And take care of the orphan, the widow, the stranger, the poor person. Don't oppress them. And don't think bad thoughts about your brethren. Don't say everyone's, don't call them names and say, they're whatever you want to call them. Just read the newspaper today. Now, because of that bad behavior, because you didn't do that, that's why God destroyed the first temple, he explains. And that's why I sent you to exile. If you want to come back, you have to fix that behavior. And God says, God tells them, things will get better one time. God's returning to Yerushalayim on the condition that Yerushalayim becomes a city of truth. There's no reason to come back if you're not going to fix your ways. And things can be great again. Old people can be sitting on the bench watching the grandchildren playing in the streets. And God's going to bring you back from east and west and bring you back to your land. You'll be my nation. I'll be your God. Things can be great again. On the condition, you build a society of emet and staka. And then God says, just like I plotted to punish you at the end of the first temple period, I plotted to bring the Babylonians in to punish you. And I didn't answer your prayers because you didn't do proper tshuva. Now came Shafti Zamamti. Now God's saying, I'm returning now. I'm plotting to bring you back. I brought Koresh in. I'm allowing you to return. I'm inspiring Darius to allow you to build again. I'm behind your return. Okay? I want to do good things for Yerushalayim. Don't be afraid. But here's what you need to do. Redemption is a two-way street. And here's specific. Here's what you need to do. And I want you to pay attention to how this echoes what we have in Megillat Esther. What I want you to do, if you want the second temple to be successful, it's not enough just to return to Jerusalem. It's what you do in Yerushalayim, what you do in the land of Israel when you return. Number one, Dabru Emet Ishet Re'ehu. See that phrase, Ishet Re'ehu? Speak truth. No more fake news and no more half-truths. Speak truth, one to the fellow man. Emet Mishpat Shalom Shitu B'Sharechem. Have truth and justice and peace in your gates. So it's work for the betterment of society. Don't play the Sinat Chinam game. Okay? Don't think badly about your fellow Jew, okay? And don't lie, and don't do things with deceit, because that's what God hates. Now, this phrase Ishet Re'ehu we have is unique to this Nevuah of Zechariah, and we have the same phrase, this idea of sending manot ish le'ehu. In the Nehemiah, we have in the holiday of Sukkot that they send manot le'inachonlo. The Chemi talks about Sukkot celebrating the holiday with those who don't have. But there's no other precedent to a holiday other than Purim where you send manot ish l're'ehu to your fellow, not someone in need, but someone just to create friendship. And plus, and also matan levyonim as well, that you have all the time. Now, finally, Zechariah gets his final answer. Remember the people asked, no, what do we do now that the temple is being rebuilt? Do we have to continue fasting? Zechariah says as follows. If you do these things, if you remember not what happened, but why it happened, and you fix your society, and you build up Yerushalayim as a city of Emet and Shalom, and you're acting properly, and that's sanctifying God, Then Komar Hashem, God says, the four fast days, Soma Revi, Soma Chamishi, Soma Shvi, Soma Siri, the four fast days that you instituted to remember Jerusalem being destroyed, okay? Yele Beit Yehuda, L'Sason, L'Simcha, L'Modim Tovim, V'Met V'Shan Mahavo. The four fast days can become holidays. Again, a fast day can become a holiday on the condition you love Emet and Shalom. Now, this idea of a fast day becoming a holiday is going to echo in Mordechai's takanot, is his institution of the customs of Purim, we'll see in a minute. Okay? So remember again, what the key phrase is. Zechariah said, if you want Jerusalem to be rebuilt properly, speak truth, ishet re'ehu, emet v'shav shivtu b'sharechem, and don't think badly about your fellow Jew. And God hates trickery and lack of justice, etc. And then the fast days are going to become holidays on the condition you keep emet v'shalom. Now, what do we find in Megillat Esther? The first letter that Mordechai sends out with the customs of Purim in chapter 9, he sends Sfarim to all the Jews to keep the laws of Purim, to do the 14th and 15th. Listen to the holiday. Yamim asher nachol bem ayudim avem v'chodesh asher napach lem yagon l'simcha me'ever l'yom tov v'asot av yimei mishteh v'simcha m'shalach monot ishrei u'matot levyonim. We have a sad day becoming a holiday, an evel from evel to yom tov, m'yagon l'simcha. So we have, just like Zechariah says, the fast days have become holidays. I'm going to have a fast day that in the year of Purim was a fast day. Now it becomes a holiday. It's Yimei Mishteh V'Simcha. And we send Manot Ish L'Re'ehu. That's unique to Purim, to each to his fellow man. And of course, Manot Levyonim. Those are all the things that Zechariah was talking about. Remember back in Zechariah? He said in the beginning, not just Ish L'Re'ehu, but in the beginning, he said, why was Jerusalem destroyed? Because Mishpat Metshfotu, Chesed Abraham Ishet Achiv, and the orphan, the widow, the stranger, being nice to the poor people and thinking kindly about your friends. There's the idea of Matot Levyonim and Manot Ish L'Re'ehu fits beautifully to the message of Zechariah, what we need to do to be worthy of having a Mikdash again and rebuilding Yerushalayim. And again, and that's going to be the first letter of Purim. Now, it seems like even though it says that everyone kept it, it looks like they weren't, we'll see in a minute, Mordechai has to write a second letter. Right? Now he says, remember, the Jews kept this forever. Right? But for some reason, there's a second letter necessary in the end of chapter 9. And let's look what the letter said. I'm assuming the need for the second letter was because the first letter either wasn't understood or wasn't being kept. Now, Esther and Mordechai write a second letter. Verse 29, we'll end with this. But Yiktob Esther Makah, Bat Abichel Mordechai Yudi, Kotokev, Lekabi, Tiger, Tapurim, Azot HaShini. They send a second letter about Purim, right? But the purpose of the letter is to make sure they keep the first letter. Why? What is the letter about? One pasuk. The letter they sent includes Divrei Shalom Ve'emet. Now, that sounds like the opening line of the letter, not the content of the letter. But if we relate this to Zechariah, then what's the content of the letter? Divrei Shalom Ve'emet is Zechariah's message about the fast days becoming holidays. And it could be Divrei Shalom Ve'emet is explaining the reasons for the strange customs of Purim of making a mishteh instead of Evel. No, Miyagon is become Evel Yom Tov, a feast day instead of a fast day. Manot Ish L'Re'ehu, as Yirmiyahu was saying, and Matron Levyonim. So it could be the Divrei Shalom Ve'emet are explaining the reasons for the customs of Purim, as it says in the next line. Why is Mordechai and Esther sending Divrei Shalom Ve'emet, I'm assuming, the message of the Nabi Zechariah, which was the most recent Nevuah Am Yisrael received in the exile? It was the answer to the question about fasting on the four fast days. L'kayem mitimei Purim eile bismanhem. In order that they keep the laws of Purim at the right time, kashir keim aleihem Mordechai Yehudi v'Esther Malka. Just like Mordechai and Esther had written to them in the first letter of Mishteh v'Simcha, and Matot Levyonim and Manot Ish L'Re'ehu, to explain why Mordechai instituted the customs of a Purim that were in the first letter. And then finally, V'kashir kimo nafsham v'azaram divrei atzumot v'zakatam. Just like they took upon themselves, just like Am Yisrael accepted to fast the four fast days to remember Jerusalem, these divrei atzumot v'zakatam have to be referring to Zechariah's fast days, not Tanit Esther, because Tanit Esther itself, as a custom for all generations, is only 1,000 years old. It started maybe in the time of the Rishonim, maybe about less than 1,000 years ago. But there was no custom of fasting on Panis Esther until recently. Panit Esther, Megillat Esther is on Pesach time and was a one-time fast, and it wasn't on Nafsham Baal Zaram. This sounds like something, an eternal fast custom. So just like the Jews accepted upon all generations to fast on the four fast days to remember Yerushalayim, now we're feasting on Purim to remember Yerushalayim. And we're sort of celebrating Purim as Pesachiah's fast day turned feast day. If that's the case, the Divrei Shalom Bemet might be coming to explain the content of the letter, not just the introduction, and explains the customs of Purim. Now, I want to talk about what I call breadcrumbs that the Megillah is leaving over to get this point across. I have a table here. You can look at it later on, comparing all the parallels between Esther chapter 9 and Zechariah chapter 8. We mentioned them all. Megillim Simcha Mevel Yom Tov. That's going to be the four fast days being the holidays. Emet Mishpat Shalom. Nasing Divrei Shalom Ve'emet in both places. Rosh Re'eyu and Ishtar Re'eyu. All the green. You can match them up later on. It's nice and simple. Now, if the assumption is correct, then the question is Megillat Esther alluding that it could be that the reason we were almost destroyed in Megillat Esther might relate to the fact that we didn't return? And if we're going to celebrate God saving us, we have to remember why God saved us so that one day we may be ready again to return and do it right. Now, if that's the case, I'll take the last lines of Zechariah right after this. God says, a time will come when other nations are going to come to Jerusalem. If Bayit Sheni gets off the ground properly, Zechariah says, things will be so good that other nations will come. Ubao amim rabim, v'gam atzumim l'vakesh Hashem tzvot b'Yerushalayim. If things are... in Yerushalayim are running properly, other nations will come for inspiration to Yerushalayim, as Isaiah had hoped for Bayit Rishon in chapter 2 of Isaiah. Then he says, Kol Amar Hashem Tzvot B'yamim Mahema, at that time, when other nations are coming for inspiration because we're doing such a good job in Yerushalayim, Asher Yechziku Asra Nashim B'kol Lashon Tagoyim, there'll be people, 10 people waiting in line from all the nations in Jerusalem, Ve'chziku B'knaf Ish Yehudi Le'mor Necharim Achem, to be waiting in line to the audience of an Ish Yehudi, saying, we want guidance, we want to follow you, because we heard that God is with you. Am Yisrael will be doing such a good job, there'll be people waiting in line for the audience of an Ish Yehudi in the Mikdash in Yerushalayim. Now, if I take that verse and say that, I'm assuming that the author Megillat Esther is aware of this, this phrase Ish Yehudi is only here in Tanakh, and of course the Megillat Esther. And where do we find an Ish Yehudi? Instead of in Yerushalayim, the Bira, he's in Shushan. And the word Bira in Divrei Hayamim is only used for the Beit HaMikdash in Yerushalayim when it's being built in the book of Divrei Hayamim. And his name is Mordechai, remember? But his parents and grandparents have Jewish names. Mordechai sounds like Marduk. It makes sense. Four generations into Babylonian exile, we already have, you know, Jewish people, but their names are more, are named after a Babylonian god. Mordechai for sure is religious and he's Jewish, but it's not by chance his name is the name of the Babylonian god, who the Persians accepted. Now, why do we go four generations? Because his great-grandfather was exiled from Jerusalem, and I'm bringing in the theme of Yirmiyahu again. Ashur glab Yerushalayim imagul asher glutayim Yehoniah melech Yudah v'ayin Nebuchadnezzar. That relates to Yirmiyahu 70 years that are over now, but they haven't come back. Again, who's the king? It doesn't mention God, but it's God behind the events. We'll talk about that next week, about why Esther is called Esther. What's being hidden in Megillat Esther? But again, the question is that opening line in Megillat Esther, if I know Zechariah, is it by chance that all these things of Zechariah are in Megillat Esther? Or is the author, Megillat Esther, assuming you know Zechariah, which was the most recent Navi, and does it relate to the fact that we could have returned to Yerushalayim, but we didn't? And then the question is, why does God save us? If God saved us, what do we do with that salvation? Now, Haman says, who's the king of the Megillah? So Haman says there's a nation that's scattered among the nations. They don't listen to the laws of their God, of their king. Is that referring to the Jews not following Achashverosh? Is it referring to Am Yisrael not following God? Now, just one other analogy, which I'm not sure if it's true or not, but it's interesting, that the very first story in Megillat Esther is about a queen. Stop this here for a minute. There's a queen. I'm saying there's a king making this massive party that all the nations are gathered. Remember in Shushan HaBira, all the nations are there. We'll read it in a minute. And to show, for the king to show off how great he is to all the nations, he invites his trophy wife to show off her beauty to everyone gathered. This was before Me Too. Right? But for some reason, for good reason, Vashti doesn't want to come. And the king is angry because he's going to look bad. Listen to how similar, if I take the analogy that all the Nevi'im use, that Am Yisrael is like a wife, like a partner, a covenantal partner with God, sometimes compared to a wife. L'chodori talks about it for sure. If God calls upon his nation to show, to return to Israel, to show off God's greatness to the other nations, it might be similar to, we'll look now when Megillat Esther real quick, to, where are we? Okay. He makes a big party. Remember, but can't make it, we talked about all this before. So he says, Mabuchan says, what Vashti did was not just something to the king, but it has ramifications in all the nations in the kingdom of Achashverosh. Okay? Because people, what? If God's people don't answer his call, what do you want from other people? Everyone's got to take the, if the queen doesn't respect the king, what do you want from other nations to respect the king? And therefore, he sends letters to every Medina, that every nation should speak its own language, to be in charge of their own home, and speak its own language. Okay. Now, is that relating to where the Jews should be at the time, back in their home, speaking their language in their own country? That you could argue. But that idea that we have a nation scattered, that the story of Vashti might be alluding to God's not being happy with God calling his nation to solve his beauty, his glory, to other nations and not returning. Of course, can't take that too far because, you know, we remain God's people. The Megillah should have about Vashti coming back, but that's there's only so much I can take in that analogy. So that way, I have to finish now because Ramadan will be online in a minute. So I'll stop here. But what I'm trying to show you is that that's the question when you read Megillat Esther. It's after Koresh's declaration for sure. But if I follow outside history, it's also after the temple's rebuilt. And if that's the case, it's some 20 years after Zechariah's Nevuah about what's necessary for the redemption to be complete, what the Jews have to do, not just return to Israel, but build a just society in Israel. And it could be that the customs of Purim, the people realized maybe we were almost destroyed because we had God's call. We didn't answer God's call. And maybe we have to remember that if we're going to thank God for saving us from Achashverosh and from Haman, maybe I need to remember that God's behind history and he's telling me that we have to return to Israel one day, but what we do when we come to Israel, how we have to behave and how we have to act. And the core mitzvah of the Purim, of Mashal Ish L'Reihu, Matan L'Avanim, and the day of celebration instead of day of sorrow, might be all alluding to Zechariah's Nevuah about remembering not what happened to Jerusalem, but why it happened. And instead of fasting to remember Jerusalem, we're feasting to remember how we have to behave and how to react when God gives us historical opportunities. It could be everything we did just by chance, and it's Purim Torah, but it might be a hidden message, and we'll talk about that next week. We'll consider next week happening before the temple is destroyed, before the temple is built. And the way Chazal, I'll explain the depth of Chazal's interpretation of putting Esther before Dayavesh, and what we can learn from why Esther is called Esther, and some other deeper meanings in Megillat Esther. Hey, Jay, was there anything in the
you want to take a quick look? There are just a few little questions in the chat.
Just tell them to me because I'll take too long if I open up.
Oh, it'll take too long for you. Let me see. Okay, hold on.
Just things that are critical for the shir because we have to finish
Esther's
up.
Esther's birth not history. Isn't the rest of the time also not history? Okay, fine. You can discuss.
I can learn history from time. It wasn't written to teach you history. I can learn history from it, but its goal is to give a message from God.
Okay, if we're not adopting foreign names, okay, the foreign names may be punishment from not just eating the Suda and the Kalim and the Beit HaMikdash, socializing with non-Jews. Okay, yeah, starting to assimilate. Yeah, I think that goes together with what you were saying about what the sin was for the people in Persia. Gave permission, okay, to talk about building temple, Baruch Hashem, your granddaughter, you should have nachas from your granddaughter. Okay. The Kalim were not put in his palace, but rather in the temple of Ishtar, to whom he attributed all his success in life.
Okay, that's Ishtar. That's why Esther's called Esther, according to some people, okay?
Okay, now I understand the basis of a Gansir Purim. Purim is the preview of the futuristic utopia we are enjoying to great now, as we must live by Divrei Shalom V'Emet every day. Okay? Esther is also the name of a Babylonian god, sure. Okay, and punishing children and grandchildren for sins they did not commit. Okay, that's a much larger problem.
Okay, that we'll deal with next week. We'll do Esther. Okay, we'll stop here. And we'll some next week we'll continue this thing, but we'll do it. We'll do Chazal's opinion and understand the depth of putting Esther before Dayavish and where that comes from and the meaning of the name Esther.
Okay. Right. Thank you. Okay. Okay. Well, okay. Everybody, you don't have to go anywhere. Rabbazak, you take your shmona dakot, bivrit ala zehuta yudi, bikola mashuk, it's any loans of her bidyuk. And of course, you didn't understand what I said, so it didn't mean anything. But okay, if I have to practice my Hebrew. I never get a chance to speak Hebrew anymore. But anyways, okay, so we'll take a short break, and then everybody can stay. Hopefully, some new people will join. Rabbi Zak will be with us. I hope in a few minutes. And I'm just going to take a quick break, and we'll see you all very soon. Please God. Okay, thank you.